call it.
I like that idea. That's good.
Andreas Mergensen. Kevin, I think it puts me off a bit that it might be like a camping trip up there. But that suit is one example of a countermeasure that's being taken. But not everyone is convinced that enough consideration is being given to the risk to astronauts' health, particularly in the plans for missions to Mars. And the Office of the Inspector General in the US has just audited NASA's plans. So what are their concerns?
So it's interesting, this. It appears that they believe that NASA is going to take longer than originally thought to develop acceptable countermeasures to the health threats that exist in spaceflight, and particularly long-duration spaceflight required to get to more distant objects, particularly Mars, I guess. And they criticise, I guess, the lack of integration between the various facets of NASA. And in some ways, you can understand it. NASA is a tremendously complex organization. There is literally rooms of rocket scientists next to rooms of life scientists, and then doctors and technologists. And there are just dozens and dozens of these sort of, you know, smaller organizations that comprise the whole. Getting to work together is a huge challenge all on its own, so it's not surprising that that's been a problem. The question is really about what people see as their definition of acceptable risk, and that's, I think, what lies at heart here. What level of risk are you willing to accept on a journey into the literal unknown? And that's hard to sort of figure, really. We're talking about a journey that is not 250 miles away. It's not even 250,000 miles away like the Moon. This is hundreds and millions of interplanetary miles and a mission that's going to last months, if not years. So it's in a different league.
Do you think it's always going to be risky then? Are there not some things that can be done to mitigate the risks?
Space will always be risky. It's risky today, whether you're going into orbit to the space station, or indeed even if you're going on a suborbital flight. We've seen tragically what happens there sometimes. And so the energies involved in this endeavour will always make it risky. Being in an environment which is so hostile that it doesn't support human life, even for a few seconds, to rely entirely upon artificial means for your survival is going to be an endeavour that has a lot of risk.
I'd like to see the risk assessment for the mission to Mars. I imagine that might have quite a few pages to it.
Yeah, and sometimes when you sit down, and I've heard Apollo astronauts, former Apollo astronauts, talk about this, and they sort of sit there and they tear their hair out and they say, wait, are you telling us that we can't do today things that we already did nearly half a century ago? And you feel that frustration in them, but they were operating in a completely different risk universe. You know, they were the warriors of the Cold War. And so, yes, it's all about risk and your acceptance of risk.
Thanks, Kevin, and do stay with us. Now, one way of working out how people might cope both physically and psychologically on a trip to Mars, which would take about 8 months just for the journey one way, is to study humans who are isolated on Earth, at one end of the Earth to be precise. Alexander Kumar spent 9 months as the doctor at the Antarctic station Concordia, which is so otherworldly he calls it White Mars. The team there endured temperatures as low as minus 80 degrees and low oxygen levels for four long dark months in winter when no one could come and go, and the team of 12 were completely reliant on each other. For the European Space Agency, Dr. Kumar conducted various physiological and psychological tests to research how his teammates were coping.
The first thing you do is sample blood, so you look at different biomarkers in the blood to see how the body's stressed. That could be anything from cortisol through to an array of about 70 or 80 different proteins, which all change during the winter, and we've had some surprises from there.
What sort of surprises?
Well, actually, because the type of environment you're in, there's a period of darkness, 3 months. There's also the cold, which doesn't impact you as much as you'd think, but also there's the isolation and the hypoxia, meaning lack of oxygen. So it's surprising because for one biomarker, for example, you'd expect, in fact, the levels to go up with hypoxia as a protective mechanism. But in fact, the isolation makes them go down. And if you can imagine, the isolation actually overwhelms the hypoxic protective effect. So that's to say that actually isolation may impact the brain more than hypoxia, which is phenomenal.
And what did you find about the people's sleep patterns and so on? Were those disrupted?
Oh, absolutely. So in the 3 months of darkness, about 2 weeks into that, people really start to fall apart. And I say that psychologically, but also physiologically. They undergo what's known as free running, where you wake up in Tahiti and you go to bed in, well, London. Your circadian rhythm begins to slip out of the normal rhythm, and so too do your sleep patterns, and so does your cognitive ability. So much so you become impaired, you become slower, you can become irritable, and all of that can start to spin out of control if you're not too careful. So you have to try and reset people and stop them going too far off.
And so were you able to see that impact that that was having on the people living there and maybe on yourself? Because the weird thing is you're kind of in this experiment as well, aren't you?
What's interesting is when you find yourself opposite patients who unfortunately suffer from depression, from schizophrenia, you yourself can quite comfortably sit and detach yourself from those, but yeah, understand as well. And I think the greatest challenge for me being down there was for the first time in Concordia's history since the first winter, I was actually the medical doctor as well as the research MD. So that's to say that I was the only doctor on the base. And in that, you want your experiments to work, you want to study people, you want to see how far they go off the charts, so to speak, because that's what's useful. But on the other hand, you need to know when to stop studying and start treating.
And what proportion of people tend to experience psychological difficulties when they're put in this kind of situation?
Well, on the ice during the winter, 10% of people will suffer serious psychiatric problems. And that's not to say that they'll be affected for the rest of their life, but whilst they're down there undergoing that period of darkness, isolation and so forth, things can go wrong.
And do you see more minor psychological issues as well?
You do. You see a lot of different symptoms, really. There's a lot of different syndromes and phenomena that happen down there. There is, for example, third quarter phenomenon, which is to say that if I put anyone in a period of isolation, about halfway through that point of isolation, if they know where that halfway point is, they actually take a bigger dip in their psychology just after that midpoint. What's interesting is you get the light back and it's almost as if people turn on the lights and then you can see everything in colour again, because during the winter you become into this prehistoric mindset where everything's in black and white. It's almost as if your neurons shrivel away and you just go down to your basic instincts of survival.
And inevitably you're going to socialise. What's the key to keeping things going? Do you play games or what do you do?
Well, I do remember, actually, there were a lot of games, in fact, down there. Of course, you don't want it to be too competitive. We took a golf set down there, so the challenge was finding the balls after you'd hit them. We took a tennis set down there to play a game of tennis, which is the world's coldest game of tennis at minus 65.
But I noticed that one of your findings was that people's reaction time slowed down, so that would make the tennis quite hard, wouldn't it?
Well, they do. And putting that into the perspective of a Mars mission, that would be the world's most complex landing in human history. And albeit probably assisted, if not led, by computers, you would want the pilots, the astronauts who are conducting that, to be at tip-top with good reaction times in case anything went wrong. But in fact, cognition is really impaired during the winter.
What you did have was good connections and good communications. So you had the internet and you could talk to friends and family and so on. Was that a good thing? Did that make it easier?
Interesting. I term that a poison chalice on the basis that actually I think most of the problems that you get down on the base arrive in your email box or by telephone or Skype or in the form of bad news elsewhere. More information can be very damaging down there, and actually I think we over communicate these days, and also a lot is lost in translation and misinterpreted, especially down there when you're not thinking straight anyway. What's interesting 100 years ago again is perseverance, the resilience, and this disconnection that Shackleton and Scott and Amundsen's men had down on the ice was actually beneficial, to the point that it made them a stronger team. It didn't make them look outside for entertainment. Communication definitely is something that needs to be considered closely for Mars missions.
Alexander Kumar, you're listening to Health Check from the BBC. Today we're looking at how the human body copes with the physical stresses of being in space and how the human mind copes with the isolation of spaceflight. I'm Claudia Hammond and my guest today is Dr. Kevin Fong. Kevin, we heard there that it seems that in some ways the body can adapt to an extent. Are there things that it can do to adapt to being in space?
Yes, and in terms of physiologically, the body has a range of changes that it makes that are appropriate for this new environment. So we know that the bones lose density in space, that the muscles waste, and that is an appropriate adaptation. You're not bearing weight, you're not doing as much work because there's no gravitational load, and so it makes sense for your body to get rid of some of that metabolic load and not maintain such a lot of mass of muscle and bone. So I find that quite remarkable, actually, that it's testament to the flexibility of the human genome that having evolved in an unchanging environment over millions, if not billions of years, it is able to make appropriate adaptations to an environment that is literally alien. There are some maladaptive changes. So particularly for the inner ear, now you've got a system of quite fine accelerometry in your ear so that detectors of acceleration, both rotational acceleration and linear acceleration. And it seems that that system needs a reference, and that reference comes from gravity. Now, when you remove gravitational load, that system seems to go haywire. And so people who go into space often feel sick for the first 48 or 72 hours, but that goes away quite quickly. After that, they may suffer with things like disorientation, you know, trouble navigating around the space station, and illusions of motion. So mostly it's adaptive. There are a few maladaptive things.
So in a way, it's remarkable what we can do.
I still think it's remarkable how adaptive these changes are when we go into space. Now, they are a problem because when you come home, readapting to coming back to a 1G environment doesn't happen fast enough to get you ready for landing smack in the middle of, you know, Kazakhstan and 1G load again. So they are maladaptive upon your return.
Thanks, Kevin. Now, anyone who's been to space never forgets their first experience of looking back at the Earth. It's something that fewer than 600 people in the world have ever had the privilege to do. But psychological research shows it can have a huge impact on the way they view life and their place in it. And millions more of us have, of course, seen those images of the Earth from space, with its massive blue ocean streaked with white and then green and beige patches of land. So does it make a difference to us too? Some credit those pictures with spearheading the environmental movement. It's been called the overview effect, and I spoke to Michael Lopez Alegria, an astronaut who flew on the space shuttle three times and spent time on the International Space Station.
For here am I sitting in a tin can.
It's really very impactful to see the place where the entirety of human history has occurred below you, looking a lot like it does on maps and globes, but actually being real. But there is a sense of the enormity of the Earth and the population of humanity compared to, you know, the seven or however many of us are on board at the time. And when you acknowledge that a little over 500 people in the history of humanity have ridden this particular roller coaster, it's quite impactful.
So what is this overview effect, and could it have a wider therapeutic potential? Trainee counselling psychologist Anahita Nizami from City University has made it the topic of her PhD.
It basically refers to when astronauts go into space and see planet Earth. And it's a shift in their awareness, and that's coupled with intense feeling of interconnection with other people, and as well as a responsibility to look after planet Earth.
You're traveling at 17,500 miles an hour, which means you go around the Earth every 90 minutes, which means you get to see the entire planet 16 times in a given day. The immensity of the planet is one thing, but you can absolutely see effects of human presence on the planet. You can see air pollution, contamination by just the different hue to the air. You can tell it's not a cloud, but something different. You can see deforestation. You can see absolutely the shrinkage of bodies of water. From my first flight in 1995 to my last in 2007, noticeable differences in the size of, for instance, the Aral Sea, Lake Chad, a lot of bodies of water have noticeably become smaller.
Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do.
And it makes you understand that we're all on this spaceship Earth together, and we've got to figure out a way to do it in harmony and in a way that's sustainable.
So does it make you worry about the Earth more?
Absolutely. I think it gives you a greater awareness of the fragility of the planet and the ecosystem, and gives you a better sense of how important sustainability is.
And if it gives people this feeling of connectedness with everyone else and makes people feel better somehow, can you see a way that this could be used therapeutically, since we can't all go to space?
Yeah, at the moment, the International Space Station and different organisations producing the content, basically, of planet Earth streamed live from space. So I was thinking about, well, how can we use this content in psychology and mental health and well-being and environmental campaigns? You know, how can we use it for good? For example, to help people with depression, with anxiety, end-of-life care, and, you know, how we can use this content. For example, you know, I know that the UN are using virtual reality at the moment to help people build a connection with problems that are going on all across the world, whether it's in Syria, because people feel quite distant about these things. So in a similar kind of concept, I was thinking about how we can use the overview effect.
Anahita Nizami, and if you want to tune in live to Planet Earth and try it for yourself, we've put a link to the feed from the International Space Station on the HealthCheck page at bbcworldservice.com. It's curiously compelling. But if the screen is black, that's because it's nighttime, so try again a bit later. Now, Kevin, if we make it to Mars, we'll barely be able to see the Earth, will we? Won't that be weird for them?
That's right. When you're on Mars, Earth is visible really only as Carl Sagan's pale blue dot. It'll be one of the sort of brighter objects in the sky. And that's something that psychologists have mused upon, what the psychological impact that would be for a crew. I guess it's akin to sailors of old being scared to sail out of sight of land. You know, this is the first time human beings will lose all contact with Earth, physical, visual, any means of communication, really. So it is interesting to think about that.
And finally, what do you think? Are humans going to make it to Mars in the 2030s, the 2040s?
It's difficult to know when. I'm pretty certain it'll happen this century. I mean, you know, we're really quite near the beginning of the 21st century. And if you look back, if you look at how different the end of the 20th century was to the beginning of the 20th century, then you can expect a lot of the next 90-odd years. And I think that we'll achieve all of that and much more.
Thanks very much, Kevin Fong, for being our guest today. That's it for today's Health Check. Helena Selby is the producer, and I'm on Twitter at Claudia.